All right, Erev Tov, everyone. Welcome to Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, Part 20. We'll look tonight at the life and Torah of Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah Ben Rav Aryeh Leib. So you all know the term Gadol Hador is bandied about so frequently, and often reflects a political or hashkafic agenda as much as it does Torah greatness, sometimes more than Torah greatness. It doesn't carry the same cachet as it once did. But Rav Chaim Ozer Grzynski was the acknowledged Gadol Hador for more than 40 years, not just by the average Jew, but by other Gedolim as well. He was really a bridge between the old world and the modern world, and so I had to deal with many new issues and formulate responses to new challenges that shape our views until today. So he was born in primitive Eastern Europe less than 2 months after the Battle of Gettysburg changed the tide of the American Civil War, and became for many decades the leading rabbi in Vilna and in all of Europe. And then he was charged at the end of his life with the awesome responsibility of devising some response to the Nazi horror. And when he died, just 10 months before the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, and the Holocaust unfolded in all its horror, Jewry was left without its leading guide, without really any cohesive rabbinic leadership that could begin to reckon with the catastrophe to come. To understand how unique Reb Chaim Ozer was, so several months after he died, in August 1940, a young Reb Yosef Ber Soloveitchik eulogized him at a conference of Agudas HaRabbanim that was held in Cincinnati. And there the Rav spoke eloquently about Reb Chaim Ozer's greatness. And at the end of this drush, which is written up in a number of books already, he compared Reb Chaim Ozer to the Kohen Gadol in this respect. The Kohen Gadol wore, among other garments, two that had unique functions. One was the tzitz, the golden plate on his forehead, on which was inscribed Kodesh Hashem. And the other was the choshen, the breastplate that contained the Urim Betumim, precious stones, on which were engraved the names of the tribes and several other words, which consulted by the Kohen Gadol to answer certain questions. The stones, the letters would light up, and the Kohen would have to deduce the answer to the question that was raised. What's the difference between the two? So the Rav said that tzitz is keneged merkaz ha-sechel v'adas. It corresponds to the intellect. And so the tzitz is the mechanism by which halachic questions are resolved. We use our minds. But the choshen that rested on Aaron's heart, that was keneged merkaz ha'ava v'chiba l'Yisrael. It corresponded to the center of love that the Kohen Gadol and God had for the Jewish people. In other words, the questions that were asked of the Urim Betumim were questions of a political nature. Should we go to war or not? Should we protest publicly or not? How do we respond to a certain aspect of modernity, and many other such questions? So the Urim Betumim generated a prophetic response that was not about halacha, was about public policy. The point the Rav was making was that the Kohen Gadol represented both. A rabbi should represent both. Answers to halacha questions and answer to public policy questions. There wasn't a bifurcation of roles that rabbis deal with purely Torah matters, and the public interest of Jews are left to the so-called professionals, then as now, secular Jews. This was the Rav's lament about modern times, but his point was that the last rabbi who functioned in that dual capacity as posek and madrich was Reb Chaim Ozer Grzynski. Most of the questions he answered, and that's really, we'll see how he spent his days, were public policy questions. Halachic questions for sure, but questions that arose in the light of changing times about conversions and the pressure of conversion, of intermarriage, dealing with waves of agunos the bitter winds of secularization and assimilation, Zionism, various kashrus issues, and many others. Because of his status and because of his acceptance, one Jewish historian labeled him the Jewish Pope, meaning the single authority, of which there has been no equivalent since. Universally accepted, universally heeded. So why, how did this happen? Why don't we have any more? Yes. You just came, I just started. That's the end of his life, we'll get there. You sit down in a movie, ask someone, how does this end? Hold on a second, we'll get there. Hey, no patience. So I don't doubt, by the way, you know, the name Chaim Ozer is a popular name amongst Jews. It's really because of him. That's my supposition, as he had no living descendants. And so many Jews wanted to use that name to memorialize him. So how did Chaim Ozer achieve this designation, this greatness, this acclaim as the Gadol Hador, and for more than 40 years? So Chaim Ozer was born on the 9th of Elul, 5723, August 24th, 1863, my mother-in-law's birthday, in the small village of Ivia. His father, Shlomo David, was the Rav of Ivia for more than a half century and was his son's first Rebbe. Chaim Ozer was frail and sickly as a child. In fact, he suffered health issues during his entire life, but he had an extraordinary mind and was soon known as the Ivia Eloi. How much of a genius was he? I thought you'd ask. Well, at age 9, he delivered a shiur in the town of Trab. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter tested him by citing a question asked by the Mishnah Lemelech on the Rambam's Hilchos Yisrael HaTorah. Mind you, he's 9 years old. So Rabbi Yisrael answered it by quoting Yerushalmi in Kiddushin. The young Chaim Ozer refuted Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's proof and quoted the Rosh on Shavuos to bolster his point. He's 9. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was amazed, and he said, for that alone, you deserve a dowry of 1,000 rubles. I don't know whether it in fact happened, but indeed, Chaim Ozer later married Rabbi Yisrael's granddaughter. So we'll get back to. As you can imagine, in addition to having a phenomenal mind, he had a prodigious photographic memory. At his bar mitzvah, he declined to give a drasha, even though they were pressuring him. He hadn't prepared, so he decided to just test the assembled. He asked them to recite a few words from the Ketzos or the Nesivos, both major commentaries on Choshen Mishpat. And from there, they would say a phrase, and he'd quote pages by heart after that. That's how he entertained the assembled at his bar mitzvah. And he had this too. He had an extremely warm and winning personality. He was always upbeat, always positive, exuded friendliness, always smiling. Even seeing the picture late in his life, you see his eyes and you see the way his mouth curls. It's like a permanent smile. At age 10, he was sent to Eishishik to learn. And from there, age 15, he went to Volozhin. We studied under the Netziv and grew closer to Chaim Soloveitchik as well. Chaim was 10 years old than Chaim Ozer. So he was aware of Chaim Soloveitchik's derech and learning, but he didn't fully embrace it, studying rather in the traditional Volozhin way. And that would later manifest itself in the long tshuvos that he wrote on the issues of the day, in which his knowledge of Shaskim Poskim were readily apparent. In 1883, age 20, he passed through Vilna, and he was asked to give a shiur, and he did so, and he astounded everyone, and so impressed the Avbeistin of Vilna, Rav Eliezer Grudzinski, no relation yet. He was offered his daughter in marriage on the spot. Eliezer Grudzinski was Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's son-in-law. At the same time, someone else in the audience, so another Talmud, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, Rabbi Eliezer Levinson, and he made the same offer. They both offered their daughters to Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. Then as now, that type of polygamy is frowned upon. So they couldn't resolve the issue, these two Rabbanim, and they went to Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan Spector in Kovna for Psak. Who gets the first claim to Reb Chaim Ozer? Yitzchak Hanan heard both sides and said, if he had a daughter, he would want him for his own daughter. But he ruled in favor of Reb Elia Grudzinski, and Reb Chaim Ozer married his daughter Leah Alta. 2 years later, his father-in-law died, and Reb Chaim Ozer succeeded him at age 22 as the leading Rav in Vilna. And just a few years later, before he even turned 30, he became the Avbeistin in Vilna. You'll remember from other discussions, Vilna did not have a chief rabbi officially from the 1760s on, due to a bitter dispute involving Reb Shmuel Avigdor, who was the last to hold the position until the late 1930s. Older Rabbonim, older Jews, did not hesitate to defer to Chaim Ozer because of his Torah greatness and his personal sweetness. Asked if he thought he was too young for the position, Reb Chaim Ozer replied that youth is a mum over, it's a temporary blemish. The years would cure him of this blemish. And they did. And Reb Chaim Ozer spent the next 55 years in this capacity as a Rav in Vilna. When little over a decade later, 1896, Reb Yitzchak Hanan Spector of Kovna died, Reb Chaim Ozer became acknowledged as the Gadol Hador, as the go-to resource for questions of halacha, public policy, personal advice, and from Jews across the world. In addition to that, Rav Dessler described him as a paragon of midos. So he wasn't formally part of the Musar movement, but they said of him he was a walking Bal Musar. He always knew what to say to people. He would take walks, I'll give you an example. He would take daily walks. One Shabbos he was walking in a forest near Vilna, and he came across a young Jewish boy who had found mushrooms in the forest. Couldn't take them back to the house because they'd know he carried. So he was digging a hole in the ground to hide the mushrooms until after Shabbos. He'd go to retrieve them. An obvious isser. Looks up, Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski is standing over him. He's shamefaced. Reb Chaim Ozer said to him, don't worry, it's not a malacha. It obviously was a malacha. But the boy was so impressed by Chaim Ozer's sensitivity that he strengthened his connection to Yadus that had been waning. Another time a cook walked in to inquire about the kashrus of an animal. Chaim Ozer examined the lung, ruled it was treif, and the cook started to scream at him. He was still a young man. Who are you? You don't know anything. The assembled wanted to physically eject the man. Chaim Ozer said, no, let him vent. He just lost money, animal, and so naturally he's upset. This happened not infrequently. When his wife said to him once that even humility has its limits, he answered, yes, and if I knew the limit, maybe one day I'll acquire that trait of humility. His love extended to all Jews. So sadly, he and his wife had just one daughter, Malka. She was stricken with a fatal illness at age 16, and she died when she was 20, and she's buried next to her parents down the cemetery in Vilna. Those who went with us this past May, we saw their graves. So what's Torah greatness? As his daughter was dying, Chaim Ozer was at her side, and he was hastily writing answers to questions that came from across the world, questions he would not be able to answer during Shiva. Tremendous act of will and self-control. So he and his wife had no other children, and so Chaim Ozer has no direct descendants. He did have a cousin, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Grudzinski, who was a big Talmud Chacham, with whom he learned when they were young. So he, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Grudzinski, came to America in 1891, and he became the Rav of two Orthodox shuls in Omaha, Nebraska, until his death in 1947. So he had longevity in that position. He wrote a number of svarim that few in Omaha could appreciate. Reb Chaim Ozer was never a yeshiva, but he was the Avd based in Vilna, and more importantly, the acknowledged communal leader. and he'd see people throughout the day answering their questions, dealing with their problems. No issue was too small. No person was beneath him. People who needed medical treatment, Vilna was a medical center, would see him. He'd guide them to the appropriate doctor or hospital if necessary, arrange for payment for them as well. People would come with their business problems. He wasn't a mystic. He was an autodidact, and he became proficient in many scientific disciplines. And of course, people would come to him to talk Torah, to share their insights and hear his wisdom. What was his day? So a younger relative of Reb Chaim Ozer wrote this about Reb Chaim Ozer. He finished Shacharis. Shacharis, we'll see in a moment, Reb Chaim Ozer, he took over the management of a famous yeshiva, Reb Milas Yeshiva in Vilna. And the Bachman would come every day, daily, to make the minyan in his home. My grandfather learned there for a time also in the 1920s. And the stream of visitors would arrive at his second story apartment in Vilna, still stands, I pointed out this past May. So people would come to his apartment, that he would daven there. I quote now, this is in Aaron Saraski's book on Reb Chaim Ozer, among others. This room was his private chamber. After Shacharis, he would head for the dining room and receive his many visitors. The crowd would burst into the rooms as into a communal domain. The house became a public thoroughfare. And he walked through, and the traditional garb of Lithuanian rabbis floated through the rooms. And his soft, warm brown eyes, without a trace of impatience, scrutinized his visitors. He felt perfectly at home among the multitudes, extending his hand in hearty welcome to each man, asked him to be seated. It seemed that the sight of the many anxious, expectant faces, hopefully uplifted, invigorated him. He often said, "My gloom vanishes when 30 people turn to me simultaneously about 30 important subjects, and I'm able to satisfy them all at the same time." He sits down, he's learning, they're talking. I could tell you, Maisa Shoya, I didn't know Reb Chaim Ozer, of course. I once was in a group of Rabbanim who visited Rav Elyashiv in his home in Mea Sharim, and he would sit there. He'd be bothered like people like us all the time. He'd sit there with a Gemara in front of him. When someone would walk in, he'd close the Gemara but keep his finger on the word he was at. And he'd greet, he would talk, friendly enough. They'd leave, he'd open the door, go back to the place. That's Reb Chaim Ozer. He has the Gemara, his other things. As he reads, someone is writing what he has to say. An elderly Rosh Yeshiva repeats his latest shiur. A woman requests a donation. A young yeshiva student consults with him on a marriage proposal. A merchant solicits his opinion on a business deal. An activist expounds at length on a political issue. And Reb Chaim Ozer's mind absorbs the dozens of different voices. When someone ceases to speak, assuming that Reb Chaim Ozer is no longer paying attention while writing a halachic responsum, he comments, "Keep talking, I'm listening." And indeed, it's seriatim. He allots money to the suffering widow, answers the rabbi's question concerning kashrus or divorce, advises the scholar and the businessman, takes a stand on the political matter. One never hears the, "What did you say?" so typical of busy men. He grasps a matter quickly, considers it, stores it in his memory, and answers lucidly, concisely, and pleasantly. The great Rav Rabbi Yerucham, the Mashgiach of Mir, said, "From him one can appreciate the greatness of man. Dozens of ideas flash through his mind at once, and not one interferes with another." That's a genius. I think I told him, the context of one of the other rabbis about the Rogatchover. They said of him that he could write two tshuvos simultaneously with each hand on different topics. All right? So you remember Rabbi Wein used to say about this, it may be true, maybe not true, but about us they don't say those things. So the fact that you even say it about him, you know, that says something. But that's the people we're dealing with. Famously, in the early 1900s, he established a kollel that became known as Reb Chaim Moses kibbutz that attracted young Talmidei Chachamim, many of whom become household names, world famous. Who learned in Reb Chaim Moses kibbutz? Reb Yecheskel Abramsky, later dying in London, Rashiv in Israel. Reb Lazer Silver, later went to America, to Cincinnati. Reb Moshe Shatzkis, later the Lomzer Yeshiva, then in Reitz. Reb Reuven Katz, later chief rabbi of Petach Tikva, grandfather of our own Avi Katz of New Milford. Reb Moshe Avigdor Amiel, later the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, many others. The group was kept small. Reb Chaim Moses subsidized them. They learned together. They spoke in learning with him, but mostly they learned amongst themselves. He always declined to start his own yeshiva, fearing that it would become too big and he wouldn't be able to administer it properly. But Reb Chaim Moser, Torah was the essence of life. What the Torah world has always struggled with is unity. And part of that is the great independence of mind and personality of Gedolei Torah. Deference does not come naturally. We see it today, you know, in the goneflation that exists. Everybody's a gone, and the plethora of new organizations, one-person organizations, in the exaggeration of minute differences between people and communities that justify a person going his own way. In 1909, a rabbinic conference was convened in Vilna, involving many of the Gedolim in Europe, the Chafetz Chaim, Reb Chaim Brisker, the Ger Rebbe, the Lubavitch Rebbe, the Fifth Rebbe, Reb David Friedman of Karlin, the Avner Nezer, the Sachachova, many others. Despite the august nature of these participants, it was Reb Chaim Ozer who was elected the chairman of the gathering. Now, this itself was an outgrowth of a meeting that had taken place in 1907 and preceded a more extensive gathering in St. Petersburg over the course of 6 weeks the next year, 1910. But just a few months after the Vilna Conference, the rabbis met in Germany and established the nucleus of the organization that would eventually become Agudas Yisrael in 1912. Reb Chaim Ozer, a little over a decade later, became the head of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. And it had a simple objective. It's interesting, didn't exist before. One objective: to unite all Torah Jews under one banner so as to confront in a cohesive way all the challenges to the generation. Secularism, assimilation, socialism, secular Zionism, the anti-Torah decrees of sundry despotic governments in Europe, and all the allures of the modern world. Without calling it what we call today, then the off-the-derech rate was very high. Jewish youth, early part of the 20th century, were being swept away. Interestingly and importantly, these leaders also opposed religious Zionism, and they saw no need to join forces with Mizrahi. So they were rabid anti-Zionists, but they hated Mizrahi almost more than they hated the secular Zionists, many of them. Reb Chaim Moser was not one of them. He was more of a non-Zionist of the sort that is common today in Aguda than he was an anti-Zionist. But the inability to work together with Mizrahi portended a century of either strife or a very cool working relationship. And this despite the best efforts of Reb Chaim Moser and Rav Kook, for whom Reb Chaim Moser tremendous respect. Remember, Rav Kook attended the Aguda Convention in Frankfurt in July 1914 with the express purpose of trying to get the Gedolim of Europe interested in the Yishuv, more interested in the Yishuv in the land of Israel. It was very poor planning, July 1914, to have a conference in Germany. World War I erupted while they were there, and because of that, Rav Kook was stranded in Europe for the next 5 years. Shortly after he returned to Israel, he was elected the chief rabbi of the land of Israel, which outraged the Haredi world, and that doomed any type of cooperation. In the 1920s, Reb Chaim Moser tried to bring about a merger of Aguda and Mizrahi, but by then the train had left the station, and the extreme anti-Zionists could not be assuaged. And Chaim Moser's personality was too genial to force the issue. Backtracking for a moment, World War I was brutal, deadly, and utterly disruptive of Jewish life. Jews were literally caught in the middle between the warring countries. Jews fought on both sides of the conflict, died on both sides of the conflict. You remember we discussed in another series that the Zionist movement had an office in London and an office in Berlin, hedging their bets because they didn't know who would win and which victor would be more beneficial to the Zionist cause. But Jews in Europe, in Israel also, suffered from the ravages of war. Starvation was real. And almost all the great yeshivos were exiled. The Tsar was on his last legs. He decided to crack down on Jewish life, including exiling Reb Chaim Moser from Vilna, among others, to Siberia. Reb Chaim Moser was tipped off, and he escaped south, first to Hamel, and then to Yekaterinoslav, as it was known then. Today it's known as Dnipropetrovsk in Ukraine, meaning they changed their name from one unpronounceable city to another unpronounceable city. He was away from Vilna for 4 years, but even in exile, Reb Chaim Moser orchestrated relief efforts, food and lodging for Jewish refugees, the establishment of Talmud Torahs to educate Jewish youth, the funding of yeshivos in the new locations away from the front. This he did by imploring Jewish philanthropists for money and then for more money. Back in Vilna after the war, he saw the devastation that had been wrought to the city and to Torah life, with the added obstacle of the newfound autonomy that Jews had. Remember, the Tsar had fallen, was overthrown, and an independent Poland was established between the wars, and Vilna between the wars was part of Poland. There was no Lithuania. Chaim Moser, in his new Vilna, established new elementary schools that were soon educating 18,000 Jewish students. He saw the establishment of orphanages in Kolim, the building of mikvos, restoration of kosher standards, even the founding of a newspaper that would promulgate the Torah idea, and the repatriation of thousands of rabbis and yeshiva students who passed through Vilna as they were in exile. They tried to rebuild their yeshivos in the towns that they had fled. Radin, Slobodka, Mir, Telz, dozens of others. They'd all been exiled because of the war. They all made their way through Vilna to seek Reb Chaim Moser's help in returning to their hometowns. And Reb Chaim Moser also dealt with the mayhem of war, the proliferation of agunos. Husbands had disappeared on the battlefield. This modern issue, too modern, the demand for conversion of non-Jewish women brought home by Jewish soldiers, or other men or women who wished to convert but were less enthusiastic about keeping all the mitzvahs, or dealing with non-Jewish children who were born to Jewish fathers, non-Jewish mothers. Chaim Moser was the first to deal with these matters in a systematic way. Rabbi Yitzchak had also. But he dealt with his characteristic kindness and humility and Torah commitment. And note, it's not to say that we adopt all his approaches today. Sometimes leniency in these areas just encourages more intermarriage, and spurious Jews cannot build or sustain Klal Yisrael. Some become good Jews, most don't. But we struggle with this until today, here and in Israel. And so in 1921, his beloved wife Leah died. In 1922, with everything else going on in the world in his life, Chaim Moser decided to publish his first book of Tshuvos, Achi Ezer. Over the next decade, several volumes were published. And he wrote in the introduction, if you look at number one in our reader, is the introduction to Achi Ezer. He says, Machshavot tugot midrotzetzet bekerav lev choshev, that these agonizing thoughts stir in the middle of the thinking heart. Hayim shat chayrum kazot mechuvenet lotzat svarim l'or alam, is now this the time? Is this the right time to be printing more svarim in the world? It's a question all Jews could ask. Am Yisrael toveh b'yam shel dmaot v'atem orim shiro. The Jewish people are drowning in a sea of tears, and you're singing the song of Torah. And then he says in the next paragraph, Ulam zekach Yisrael sov alelokav. Ulatarta bechol hadarot. This is in fact the great strength of eternal Israel to God and its Torah in every generation. Even when there's a sharp sword munachat al tzavarav on the neck of the Jewish people, Torah Hashem Itos Shashuv Kol Yom. It's the Torah that's our plaything that gives us not only joy, but gives us survivability as well. The range of tshuvos that he dealt with is as remarkable as their relevance until today. The conflict between tradition and modernity and all the problems that engenders. So for example, look at number 2, which is the first tshuva published in his first volume. Achiezer, Ebenezer, Chelek Aleph, Simon Aleph. Just for, it goes back to 1887. Just follow the soap opera. Woman is married, Jewish woman is married to her husband, has an affair. Then she converts to another religion and has a child. The father is an apostate Jew. Meanwhile, her first husband marries another woman without giving his strange wife a get. He dies without any children. He has 2 brothers, and so now his second wife, in theory, might need chalitza. Is it indeed true that the second wife needs chalitza? So he has a long tshuva discussing the ramifications. Remember, the complication here is that technically he's still married to his first wife. Or do we say, no, he's not married because she became a mumeres. She left the faith entirely, became an apostate. It just, you know, the people always think that everyone in Europe was a tzaddik. It's not true. Most were far from it. Let's look at some of the other tshuvas that he dealt with. Number 5 is on the left side. So here's this case. The case was asked before he left Wiesbaden. Benochris shenises liyisrael baderech sivili b'America. Non-Jewish woman, married a Jew, civil marriage in America. Now they came back to Europe. She wants to convert, all right? But she doesn't want to observe the mitzvahs. And she says, though, if she doesn't convert, they'll go to Reform Beis Din and convert. Vagioras lo yeshom kedas. And of course, there won't be acceptable. So what do you do in such a case? So he says, at first, it bays, Aldasim lekabel gioras lechor din poshe de mekabel. How do you accept someone to convert for conversion purposes? They have no interest or intention of observing the mitzvahs. But then he says there's a place to be mefakvek based on something that Shlomo Kluge wrote. And if you just skip down to Zion, after the revolution, Shaisa bime milchama gdola, after the revolution in the First World War, but I think it actually means the Tsarist Revolution because this goes back to 72, which was 1912. That Hutar Hagioros, Vigam Hukar al Pi Chok Venimusim Nisu Ezrachim, there was a recognition already of civil marriage as something. He was asked this question many times, and he says Shlomo Kluger was Makil in such a case. Makil, because he said that if you don't marry, the case of Shlomo Kluger is if the husband said, if you don't convert my non-Jewish wife, I will convert to her religion. All right? Tzadik. So Shlomo Kluger, Hela Lahakel Ulahatir, he said, you could be Makil and do it to prevent him from greater Isurim. So he says, at first, that a fit basin should not convert, but nonetheless, you look at the last line, Alkei Nira, Delefi Ra'os Ene Basin, Yesh Makom Lahakel Velisma Chaharas Agam Shlomo Kluger. So if a basin sees fit to do it, lemigdur milsa, to convert someone on such a basis, then they can do it to prevent them from greater sins. I'm saying, he says, grants me lenient if a basin kosher approves, but nonetheless, it's hard. You could do that in a small number of cases. If you start doing it en masse, you wind up with an unrecognizable Jewish people. Look at number 3, another case. A Jew falls in love with a non-Jew woman, wants to convert, All right. Oh, this is just another soap opera case. They have children. They have a son. The husband wants the son to be given a milah. Milah to be performed by Shnei Rofim Arelim, two non-Jewish doctors, and it was in front of the rabbi, and then they're going to do the bris, and they saw the child was already circumcised, and they didn't know what to do. And then Hotziu Kol, that this woman that he thought was non-Jewish, it could be that either her mother or her grandmother were Jewish, so maybe she is Jewish. So the question is, what to do with this child in all the sveikas that exist now? Whether the mother's Jewish, and what to do if the child's already mohol? So he said, in the end, they should do atof hasdam bris, but still, you have to be bodek, her story, a little more, to find if it's for the purpose of gerus. One of the things that he dealt with at length is this question of children, and this tshuva actually reverberates until today. It says, not on the page, it's in Chela Gimel Chav Ches, 1894. He was asked to convert children, and the question was, can they be moches? So the din in the Gemara is that a child who is converted, it's done al das beis din, and the child is all right, come bar mitzvah, I don't want to be part of the Jewish people, doesn't want it. Now, we say, so he says, how do we do al das beis din? It's only didafka ba'ofen she yisnahi ki Yisrael have yischus gomer. Because we say that it's a zchus for the child to be a Jew, all right? Zachin la'adam shol b'fanov. It's a source of merit to be a Jew. So he says, male, it's a source. If he's religious, then it's chus gamur. If it's chus gamur, then b'kagavna en yachalim chos. The child's not allowed to do it. When can the child do it? Avo ba'ofen she yisnahig be'isr. Afti dimikol makom hevi zchus, efshar delo hevi zchus gamur. It's not a complete zchus. If the child's not going to be religious, and there he can be moche and say, I don't want to do it. The problem is, how is the child moche? He grows up in a family that does not observe Shabbos, so he's not going to observe Shabbos. He's like his parents. That's not even a good mocha. Raksha over avera ki Yisrael. He's just violating the Torah like many other Jews are doing. He says, no. Ein lebeis din kosher lizdakek b'inyon ageris keila. A fit beis din should not get involved in these cases. Ach ein ani motzei l'nachon she'ar ishol zeh rabbani ador. I don't feel it necessary to scream about these matters, to make a big tumult. V'lotzeis b'mechol galuya neged ageris. Talk about publicly against this type of conversion. Ki be'enei amei ha'aretz zel kechil Hashem. She'enom menichim anashim lizgayer b'frat hayeladim. He doesn't feel it's necessary to make a public protest and denounce. It's the very famous tshuva, which is used until today to rationalize the conversion of children of parents who are not shomer mitzvahs. Again, it's workable when it's a handful of people. It becomes unworkable when the numbers reach into the thousands. In the case of Israelis from the former Soviet Union, the hundreds of thousands. Then it's not such a good option. Well, a very famous trivus, number four here, Chela Gimel Simon Lamed Gimel, about gelatin. So we don't generally accept Rechaim Moses' opinion. He said, can you use Efshe Lahach Shemin Avak Chadash Asher Motzao Matzomos Yaveshos? Can you use this powder that comes from dried animal bones and you mix it together with some other chemicals? Can you use that as a base, a stabilizer in food? So Chaim Oza permitted gelatin with less than shishim, less than 1/60th, because he said the bones have dried and the form has changed and has been turned into something inedible. Agav Orcha, the conservative rabbinate, accepts this prominently with Chaim Oza's tshuva on their banner, as if they accept everything else that he says. So the truth, we hold generally like Moshe Feinstein, Baron Cutler, who held that gelatin made from treif bones, might be Nisudoraisa, certainly if it's made from pork, or mushrooms, Masupik, And of course, if you make something inedible into something that's edible, then you have a din of achshavei, of you've construed it now as something edible, regardless of the process of getting there. The truth is, the Sfardim are much more lenient in this, and that's why gelatin is more common in Israel than it is here. The parameters he set for dealing with agunos, missing husbands, not the recalcitrants today, guide us until today. Can you trust the War Department? The War Department, in the particular case it was France, said they have a record this man died and was buried. Can you believe them? What about the chain of testimony? Chela Gimel, Simon Tess, follow this. Can you free an aguna? Al pi edus ha'ed mi pi ha'ed ve'edus b'shem hanochri sheyasofek meisich litfituma aydei sheilo. Someone innocently asked a non-Jew, whatever happened to Joe? And Joe told A, the non-Jew told A, Joe died, A told B, B told C. Can C, is C's edus valid? He's so far removed from the case. Is it valid? Some chidushim, you should know, recorded in Achiezer, go back to Chaim Ozer, was a teenager still learning in Volozhin. One final case, in the 1930s, Chaim Ozer was the leading voice opposing a relaxation of Shechita standards, in particular the permission of electrical stunning of animals before slaughter that hostile non-Jewish governments insisted on, then and now, by the way, on the pain of banning Shechita entirely. So several rabbinic voices who want to allow it, fine Rabbanim, even the Sri Deish proposed it, Shas Hadchak. He drafted a whole heter, presented his proposal, but conditioned on Chaim Moses' acceptance. And here Chaim Moses said no. It could not be permitted, both on halachic grounds and on public policy grounds, of encouraging our oppressors that they can demand changes in halacha whenever they wish. In fact, one of his last tshuvos in 1940, the war had already started, he reiterated to the Swiss rabbinate not to permit stunning of animals. By the way, at first they didn't stun the animals, they hit them over the head with a mallet, which seems to be a little more painful than Shechita, but that's just me. He answered to the Swiss rabbinate that, I quote, "We are an ancient people, old and gray from tsaras and enemies, yet all our enemies in the past have vanished, and we still exist. That is because of our Mesiris Nefesh for Torah." You have to without meat, you have to import meat, that's what you have to do. There are very few issues that preoccupy us today with which he did not deal and with which the opinion of Reb Chaim Ozer must be reckoned. So agree or disagree, because of his greatness in Torah and his widespread acceptance, all subsequent poskim have to deal with his opinions. In the early 1920s, he embarked on another project, major project, together with Chafetz Chaim. They saw the great danger of the Torah world. It's after World War I. And especially the penury, the financial struggles of the yeshivas. So together, Reb Chaim Ozer and the Chafetz Chaim created the Vada Yeshivas organization. What seems obvious to us now was not obvious then. Then each yeshiva raised funds on its own. Some were more successful than others. The unsuccessful, small yeshivas in small towns, were always in danger of closing, leaving their Jewish populations bereft of any makom Torah. The Chafetz Chaim was older, of course, by 25 years or so, but they had enormous respect for each other. Each, at a certain time in the 1920s, prevented the other from making aliyah, saying, Klal Yisrael takes precedence. Each would refuse to sign proclamations before the other signed. The Chafetz Chaim insisted, Reb Chaim Ozer is the Morad Asra of Klal Yisrael, he should sign first. Reb Chaim Ozer insisting, no, Chafetz Chaim, he's the Chafetz Chaim, he has to sign first, until Reb Chaim Ozer said, the Chafetz Chaim is a Kohen. The Kidashto, a Kohen must be honored first. Chafetz Chaim agreed, as long as Reb Chaim Ozer signed alongside him, not underneath. So you see, even the documents of the time, if many Rabbanim sign, but at the top, it'll be the Chafetz Chaim, Reb Chaim Ozer, side by side. So they worked together, established an organization to provide kosher food to Jewish soldiers, and here they established the Vada Yeshivos that would raise funds for all the yeshivos to be distributed by the Vod based on the criteria they would establish. So they want the fundraise to be more mechubad than door-to-door. So if you look at the flip side, number 6, Kol Torah is printed in Eitz Chaim. Ma nachnu machashim? Why are we silent? For what are we silent? He said there's several different, this is Chaim Moses' words, there's several different inyanim in the world. There's certain matters that are tied to the nefesh, the soul, others to the guf, the body, nefesh. Some are connected to the body and the soul. Some to the prat, an individual. Some to the klal, the nation. Here we're talking about something that affects kol beis yisrael legufam ulenafsham. So they turn to the rabbanim, gaonim, balei Torah to establish this vad. Madua anu machashim. We see the Torah mitmotetet miyom al yom. It's faltering every day. Umalifnim, in the past, a deterioration that would take decades, now happens in just a single year. Umemela, gam koach ha'emuna v'adat mitrofeif, panofein ha'rabim, v'shichar ha'Torah alakol. Now emuna is being lost, the faith is wavering, God forbid, and forgetting the Torah is the worst of all sins. So he said in number 7, this was their proposal. There are 7 different proposals. First, every Jew in the exile is obligated to give twice a year $1 to the Vadi Yeshivos. Everyone is obligated to give $1 twice a year, spring and fall. Whoever can give more should give more. Dalid, who collects the money? The rabbis of the town. So each town has to go to each Jew in the town and ask them for their contribution. Each town has to set up their own local vod, and then it has the date. The latest date for Kayetz is on Yom Kippurim. The latest date for until Yisrael Mitzvah, and for Choref Yom Kippurim. I mean, that was just the end date. That was the decision that they made. The rabbi had to ensure compliance. It worked for the most part. Collections are always a problem, but it was a new concept. And it got all Jews to think in terms of a national obligation to support Torah, not just a local obligation. For decades, Rav Chaim Moser would guide yeshivos across Europe in selecting their Rosh Yeshiva. He would guide young men, learn here, learn there. That too was part of his job description as he saw it. But he saw his primary role as dispenser of tzedakah, which he kept meticulous records, being open to every Jew who sought him out. Sometimes he sought them out. One spring, he called in the head of the Jewish Students' Union at the university in Vilna. He was not observant. He gave him an envelope of money, and he said to him, "I know you're not observant, but take this money, and please use it to buy matzah for all the Jewish students. If I do it, they won't be as accepting of it as they will be if you do it." V'chein hoya, the student was very impressed by it. Now, I know Reb Chaim Moser wasn't a Zionist by any means, but he had tremendous respect and interactions with Rav Kook, both in Europe and through correspondence. Remember, we discussed this once before, Rabbi Zalman Meltzer said to Rav Chaim Moser after Rav Kook died, "We're all gedolim until we get to his door." And then Rav Kook just exceeded all of us. Rav Chaim Moser was not like his brother-in-law. And after his wife died in 1921, a few years later, he remarried Yacha, who was the daughter of Rav Meir Atlas. So his brother-in-law was Rav Chanan Wasserman, Shem Yikom Damo. Rav Chanan was passionately, both married sisters, he was passionately and unalterably anti-Zionist. Rav Chaim Moser supported the Orthodox Yeshuv. He essentially declined to take a position on the Peel Commission deliberations on partition. So he couldn't attend because of ill health. The Aguda Knesset in Marienbad 1937 that dealt with an Aguda approach to partition, but he sent the following letter. He said, "You've decided to turn to me regarding the burning question of our world, the question of partitioning of the land, which it seems already has the approval of the British government. It's truly a difficult question, and the rabbinical authorities must not ignore it letting it be decided by others, but they aren't sure what to do. Should they come out with a sharp denunciation of any partition, demanding complete Eretz Yisrael, then what will they gain if the government backs down and leaves the dangerous situation as it is now? But if we agree to the idea of partition on condition that the borders be widened, it's doubtful if even a quarter or a third of our demands will be heeded. If we're extremists and protest any partition, on the other hand, and the government desires our approval, it will make concessions and we will get wider borders. This question requires Das Torah and knowledge received by tradition of how the Jewish people act in such situations. Thus you have termed to me. It seems the Torah viewpoint is that we should make efforts in all general areas for the good of our people and our holy Torah. As far as the good of our people, with partitioning of the land, providing a small area for Jewish state, it's very doubtful if the Yishuv could spread there. All the more so, since they'll be surrounded by enemies. As many of the elders of the Yishuv have said, that the shadows are more than light. And as far as our holy Torah, if it will be government of the non-religious, who knows what the results will be? It is unnecessary to elaborate. But we can guess that after the decision, the Zionist Congress and the agency, if the mandate government wants partition and is persistent about it, it will not take into account the opinion of others. It will do as it pleases. Then it will be our obligation to make efforts inside and outside, stand watch and make sure that the new state's constitution should ensure religious matters and all Torah-based demands to the last detail. For now, we must keep our attention on the events, and time will tell how we are to proceed. Well, what did he advise them? Yeah, in other words, wait and see, which is a classic Aguda position. So in that sense, he was limited by his generation and his contemporaries. See, he rejected and certainly did not join several Mizrahi initiatives to boost religious life in Israel. And even the Vada Rabbanim was founded for European rabbis in 1920 to boost their status and standardize their salaries, only included rabbis of whom he approved. I mentioned earlier, in the late 1930s, the Soviets insisted Vilna have a chief rabbi. Rabbi Yitzhak Rubinstein was appointed the chief rabbi, and he was mocked by the Haredi world as the Rav Mitam. The fact is, he was a frum Jew. He was a Mizrahi also, the religious Zionist, university educated. So he worked out, with Chaim Ozer, a pleasant working relationship, never stepping on his toes and showing respect. And it was mutual, but he never really had the position. And so he was fortunate enough, because he was never fully accepted, he was able to leave Vilna in 1938-39, came to America, became a Rosh Yeshiva and Reitz, in fact, and died in 1945, but at least he escaped the Holocaust. In a sense, like many of his generation, Chaim Ozer was more open to dealings with secular Jews and leaders with whom there could be a clear demarcation than with more modern but religious rabbis with whom he felt there were possible dangers in association. So to them, but with them, he dealt as individuals, but not part of any organization or movement. So the last chapter of his life was tragic for him and all Klal Yisrael, and his death was really more depressing than most. Chaim Ozer was afflicted with cancer in 1936. He suffered for 4 years. No one outside his immediate confidants knew about it. He did not even want to enter a hospital for fear of the panic that would ensue for Vilna and European Jews. And concurrent with his illness, the Nazis were on the march. Jew hatred was spreading throughout Poland. Remember, this is the time Poles banned Shechita. The winds of war were blowing, and Jews looked to this ill, frail genius for guidance, as it always looked to the Gedolim. In the introduction to Volume 3 of Achiezer that he wrote in June of 1939, less than 3 months before the war started, he wrote of the portents of a devastating war and the collapsing world around him, both physically and spiritually. And look at number 8, to the flip side, the bottom left, the Akdamat Achiezer. It's a time to act for God because they've nullified the Torah. And now the great mandate of the era, the responsibility upon us Manara matzav amenu. How terrifying is the condition of our people. Lo haisa kazos gam bimei abeinayim. Even in the Middle Ages, we didn't have it this bad. Asher kol hagolah kimeduras esh. The whole exile is like a bonfire. Botei medrashos v'sifrei Torah nisrafim v'rosh kol chutzos. The burning sifrei Torah, botei medrash. Ugzeros kashos mischachos aidei sonenu. Migadenu lahavir al das kachenu. And terrible decrees are renewed every day by our enemies who just want to destroy all the kehilos. He says, next paragraph, Achrei kol eila cholina lonu l'siyayish. It's forbidden to us to despair. Aleinu lashuv b'leiv av shalem. We have to repent with a full, perfect heart. Batzar l'cham tzucha, pasuk of Aschanan. V'shavtas Hashem elokecha. We have to do whatever we can. We have to try to speak to the hearts of those who are suffering, the abused, the tormented, the exiled. Strengthen with comforting words. Encourage their broken spirits. V'chule, v'chule. Read it yourself. It's really terrifying words. He says the Jewish people are drowning in rivers of blood and seas of tears. There's no respite, west and east. The reform, assimilation are destroying their souls, and we're struck by blindness. He sensed there was something different about the Nazis. In a remarkable story, in the early 1930s, he welcomed to the basement of Vilna a 22-year-old Rav Yisrael Zev Gustman, who had succeeded his father-in-law, much like Chaim Ozer had done. Rav Gustman was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a sweet and gentle man who barely survived the Holocaust. He later said that he recited Vidui hundreds of times during the Holocaust. He had to endure before his eyes the murder of his own only son, young son. He was once shot in the head, Rav Gustman, by the SS and left for dead, but the bullet had penetrated his skull, damaged nothing vital. When the Nazis left that scene, he waited, got up, and fled. It was Rav Gustman who primarily had to deal with the woes of Vilna Jewry in the early years of the Holocaust. He eventually survived, came with his wife and surviving daughter to New York, made Aliyah in the 1970s. In fact, became the Rashi of the Rav Milos Yeshiva in Berchavia. Rav Gustman said the following. In 1939, early 39, he was traveling right outside of Vilna with Reb Chaim Ozer. Reb Chaim Ozer liked to take walks. They walked into a forest. Reb Chaim Ozer said to him, "Look here, remember this cave." And he made a mental note. And then he pointed out, Reb Chaim Ozer did, various plants and mushrooms. And he said to Rav Gustman, "These are edible, these are poisonous." It was to that cave Rav Gustman eventually hid with his wife and daughter when the ghetto was liquidated, and they spent a few years there. And they lived off these plants and mushrooms and berries for a long time. To Rav Gustman, it was an example of Rav Chaim Ozer's genius and his prescience and his Ruach HaKodesh. And yet nothing is ever simple, certainly not simplistic. What was Chaim Ozer's response to the growing Nazi threat? So admittedly, hindsight is always 20/20, and it's wrong. It's wrong to fault anyone for failing to predict the unpredictable. Rav Chaim Ozer already in 1933 opposed the boycott of German products that was being advocated by some American Jewish groups in response to the Nazi boycott of Jewish stores. He felt that German Jews would bear the brunt of the German retaliation. So what was there to do? There never was a good answer. So all the decisions that he made, in context, are very logical. In the real world, they didn't always play out that well, because no one could anticipate the gravity, the magnitude of the horror. So he never advocated that Jews go to Israel, never advocated that she even flee. And oddly, again, at first glance, it was understandable in context, because when the war broke out in September 1939, when the Nazis and the Soviets invaded Poland from west and east respectively, He urged Jews and yeshivos to take refuge in Vilna. Why? Because Vilna was not occupied by either the Nazis or the Soviets. It functioned as a sort of free, independent city. That was the desire of the Soviets. They annexed Eastern Poland in 1939, but not Vilna. They didn't want to be responsible for it. So Vilna actually maintained a sort of autonomous status. So, in 1939, 1940, because of Heimoser and others, tens of thousands of Jewish refugees fled to Vilna from Poland and elsewhere in Lithuania. They flocked there, including 4,000 yeshiva students, and many, many rabbanim, famous ones. Rabbi David Lifchitz came from Suvalk, Rabbi Moshe Shatskis, the Brisker Rav, Velvel Soloveitchik, many others. They all felt they would be safe in Vilna, and in fact they were for a time, because it wasn't the war zone. Neither the Soviets or the Nazis were there. Conditions were extremely harsh. Through the cold Vilna winter, dozens of people slept every night in shuls in the Batei Medrash. And Reb Chaim Ozer, now sick with cancer and debilitating, took responsibility not only for food and lodging. He had the excruciating task of raising funds from an ever-diminishing group of donors, and he soon reached out to American Jewry, where the Vadat Sol had been founded in November 1939, originally for the express purpose of rescuing the yeshivas. Reb Moshe also insisted that the yeshivas not consolidate, which might have made more sense in terms of efficiency, but rather each yeshiva retain its own identity, its own makom, what in retrospect seems like a luxury. But it's also part of Hester Panim. The great Mizrahi leader of Zerach Verhaftig, who later served more than a decade as Sar Datot, offered Chaim Ozer a visa to Israel. He naturally declined to leave Vilna, but he also declined the offer that apparently was made to transfer all 4,000 yeshiva students to Israel on student visas. And by the time he would have agreed, it was too late. By the spring of 1940, that's when the Soviets did enter Vilna, and emigration became a near impossibility. It was Rav Verhaftig, among others, who intervened with the Japanese consul in Kovno, Senpo Sugihara, to issue exit visas through Japan, with the final putative destination being Curacao. That the work of another righteous Gentile, the Dutch honorary consul in Vilna, Jan Svartenjijk. Thousands were saved. But Reb Chaim Ozer was always reluctant to urge this path. And the Mira Mashiach of Yecheskel, Chatzkel Levenstein, said it's because it smacked of dishonesty. They weren't going to Curacao, nor did they really want to go to Japan. See, quote Reb Chaim Ozer is saying, something crooked doesn't become yashar because it succeeds. Rather, it succeeds because Atzas Hashem Hisakum. Again, who knew? Even when it was bad, who suspected that it would be anything worse than Kishinev, than another pogrom? Who suspected it would be industrial-sized extermination? One of his Talmidim later said, Reb Chaim Ozer appealed to Rav Herzog for 1,000 immigration certificates, but by then little could be done. It was all uncharted waters. The future was not just a mystery, the future was a black hole. And, add to that, for Russian citizens, once the Soviets came in, the desire to emigrate was itself a crime. So one could easily leave on a Sugihara visa, for example, and wind up in Siberia, or dead. So as long as Vilna was safe, Vilna was safe. The operative principle was, if leaving Vilna was dangerous, and staying was dangerous, Shev al tase odif. That's what Halacha teaches us. It's true, one summer Friday, German planes flew overhead, bombed the city. Chaim Ozer told the American students who were there, they, of course, were Americans, they could go back to America, to leave immediately, even though they'd be traveling on Shabbos. And he made arrangements for them to leave Europe through Riga, v'chein haya. People did not know what to do. Nothing was certain. They sought guidance, but the guidance itself was speculative. And worse, Chaim Ozer is now dying of cancer. October 1939, a month after the Nazi invasion, where Baruch Ber Leibovich, the great Rosh Yeshiva Kamenetz, died. In November, Rav Shimon Shkup died. With that, Rav Chaim Ozer said, their Amelus B'Torah, that was protecting the Jewish people, was now gone as well. And I quote, the way is open for Germany. Thursday night, August 8th, 1940, bedridden, racked with cancer, he gave instructions regarding the distribution of tzedakah accounts he maintained. He wished everyone a good night, and then said, who can be zocha to having a good night? And even so, I have no tainus chas v'shalom to the Ribono Shalom. August 9th, 1940, Friday morning, the 5th of Av, the 9 days, just how gloomy the scene was, Reb Chaim Ozer succumbed to his illness. The Jews of Vilna were shocked and bereft, literally left leaderless at this critical time. On Sunday, tens of thousands defied the Soviet authorities and attended his funeral. His brother-in-law, Reb Chaim Novosny, eulogized him by saying, Reb Chaim Ozer belonged to a different generation of Gedolim. We already feel the darkness of his absence. Less than a year later, Reb Chanan would be dead, murdered by the Nazis in cold blood at the 7th Fort in Kovno. Reb Chaim Ozer's second wife, Yacha, she'd be murdered by the Nazis as well in Vilna. And Polish and Lithuanian Jews were now missing the light that had guided them for more than a half century. There was now no one who had the authority and the respect to look after their needs, even to evaluate the variety of bad options before them. The sense of foreboding loomed large, and when the Nazis invaded on June 22nd, 1941, Vilna's fate and that of Polish and Lithuanian Jewry was sealed as well. Since the days of Rabbeinu Gershom in the 10th century, Jews have always acknowledged, albeit not unanimously, someone as the Rosh Kabahag, the Rosh Kol B'nei Hagola, the head of all the Jews in the exile, the leader of all the Jews in the exile. Of Reb Chaim Ozer Grudzinski can be said he was really the last Rosh Kabahag, the last head of all the Jews in the exile. As the exile itself started to burn and then to slowly disappear, and the locus of Torah life shifted to the land of Israel, he really was, in his leadership and his greatness, the last of a very long era. Yehi Zichro Baruch. I thank once again everyone for coming.